We're hearing a case for why public lands should be protected and connected in large blocks, large chunks that would span the continent in order to help wildlife adapt to a warming climate. You're with us for this conversation on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. America's public lands unite people from all walks of life, and the federal government owns 640 million acres. That's about 28% of the land in this country. We're taking a closer look at how these public lands are potentially harmed, especially in the midst of climate change. Do you think private lands should be open for public development? What about logging and drilling operations? Do you think federally designated lands should be devoted to conservation or open to development options? The number is 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Stephen Nash is a visiting senior research scholar and an adjunct faculty member in the Journalism Department and Environmental Studies Program at the University of Richmond. His most recent book is called Grand Canyon for Sale, Public Land versus Private Interests in the Era of Climate Change. Stephen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. So, nice to talk with you.
Yeah, so we tend to think of national parks as these islands of conservation, that there's like this barrier around them. But you've argued that in order to protect national parks, we need to worry about places outside of them and specifically other public lands. Why is this?
It's because of climate change, principally. But it's always been the case that as wonderful as our national parks are when you visit them, and although they look pretty substantial on a map, they've never been quite large enough biologically to sustain the wildlife that's so important to us. Grand Canyon, over the years since it was established, and it's been 100 years this month since the national park was created, Grand Canyon has lost 20% of its mammal species. It is just too small a home to keep those populations going. With climate change, all of those islands are, in effect, going to be moving south climatically. So is Wisconsin. But if you look at Grand Canyon as an example, or Yosemite or Yellowstone National Parks, they're going to be moving 400 miles south in terms of their climates between now and the next few decades and then the end of the century. And what that means is all of the plants and animals, species that live within the parks are going to have to, some of them are going to have to be adapting by migrating north. If they have public lands available, they can do that.
Right. So where do public lands enter this equation? How could they be helpful with that forced migration, if you will?
Let's go back to something you said just a moment ago, which is very important and was very hard for me to grasp when I began looking into all of this, that nearly a third of our national landscape is federal public land. That's an enormous amount of land and a huge opportunity. When we say federal public land, we're talking about national forests. And help me with pronunciation, Shequamagon.
Nicolet. You're in the neighborhood.
Okay. All right, that's great. So national forests, wildlife refuges, national monuments, which aren't like the Washington Monument. Actually, some of them are 1 million acres or more. All of those public lands and others that I haven't named, if they are consolidated and if they are protected more or less along the lines of how national parks are protected, that means those plants and animals that are trying to adapt to climate change will have some place to go. As that climate moves south, in effect, getting hotter and hotter, animals will have to migrate north, and public lands will let them do that.
We're talking about what happens to public lands with Stephen Nash as our guide. He is a visiting senior research scholar, adjunct faculty member in the Journalism Department and Environmental Studies Program at University of Richmond. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you think should be done to protect national parks and other public lands in the U.S.? Do you live near federally designated land, like the Ice Age Trail. How do you see it being protected? How do you see it being compromised? 800-642-1234. Tweet us WPR Mornings. Stephen, let's talk about policy. What legal protections do national parks have that other public lands do not?
The important ones for this conversation are that you can't do mining in a national park, and you can't drill for gas and oil, you can't harvest timber, and you can't, except under extraordinary circumstances, graze cattle. We still have cattle grazing in a few national parks for reasons of decoration, I guess, but those are the main stress factors on those other public lands outside national parks that you can't do in a national park. The landscape is the priority there, and the wild species that need that habitat.
Well, let's look at logging for a moment. Loggers in the Shawamagon-Nicolet National Forest harvested about 14,000 acres of the more than 860,000 acres available for timber harvests in the National Forest last year. And this was done through the Good Neighbor Authority, which is this authority that gives the state to basically go through with managing National Forest land. Is the federal government's Good Neighbor Authority protecting National Forests?
If we look at national forests generally, no program is protecting them. Nothing protects them from climate change. What forest management practices dictate as climate change comes on the national forest is that they need to be managed in certain ways. The species are going to change. In the Shawamagon-Nicolet, for instance, sugar maple and balsam firs are going to be under increasing stress, and bur oak and white oak are, as an example, of species that are going to come in instead. Those forests need to be managed not to prioritize timber harvesting, but to prioritize natural systems. It doesn't mean there's no place for timber harvest. It means it has to be very carefully handled.
How does the pace of climate change factor into this? If animals are having a difficult time migrating and adapting, what are the chances that tree species that thrive on our national lands and take longer to develop, you know, will they make it?
That's a question that science has not yet answered. There have been calculations about how fast some tree species can move. And, of course, a tree can't move, but it's some wonderfully interesting science about how the pollen moves, how the seeds move, and whether the wind or the squirrels or some other factor can move them north fast enough to keep up with climate change. But you put your finger on a crucial matter. It may be that they'll need help from us to move as they try to adapt, because sometimes they're not going to move as fast as the climate is moving.
And do we see this happening right now? Do we see evidence of this?
We do in some places, and northern places especially are beginning to see some changes because they're feeling the advancing heat more rapidly. But, you know, it was just announced yesterday by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration that 2018 was the fourth hottest year on record, and the three preceding years were even hotter. We're watching forests to the south. As you know, they go up in flames by the millions of acres. There are several reasons for that, not just climate change, but scientists tell us that at least it's a kind of a dim preview of what a lot of our forests are in for.
We're talking about how to protect public lands in the face of climate change with Stephen Nash as our guide. He's a visiting senior research scholar at the University of Richmond. You can join in 800-642-1234. Do you have a connection to a forest? Do you see it being protected? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings, back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're We're talking about protecting public lands on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. One day before the longest government shutdown in history, President Trump issued an executive order that called for increased logging and forest thinning on more than 4 million acres of public lands. And this was an effort to combat extreme wildfires. But some environmental groups are saying this move ignores the role climate change plays in starting wildfires. It's one of the threads we're talking about as we look at how public lands are preserved and protected. Do you think public lands should be open for private development? What do you think should be done to protect national parks? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to the phones now with Dave joining us from Fort Atkinson. Dave, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What are your thoughts here?
Well, a thought occurred to me. The U.S. has been managing public lands for, a couple of hundred or a hundred or more years. And the thought occurred, why not put the control over it back to the First Nations, and specifically the First Nation, tribes that occupied the land before we took it from them. And they would still be public lands just like they are now, but instead of President Trump dictating that logging will happen, the tribes will figure that out and kind of dictate that direction. And I'm curious to see what you guys think of that.
Stephen Nash, what do you think about moving the authority to tribal nations?
I think I've spoken with biologists, actually, who suggest a kindred idea, that there is a lot of knowledge, sort of generational knowledge, in many tribal councils about how the land used to be managed in a much more sustainable way. The current administration has not only decreed that we'll have 30% more logging, oil and gas leases have tripled during the Trump administration. It's no secret that President Trump has said that he's not interested in science, doesn't believe climate change is a problem. The First Nations have been first in line to protest that the Trump administration has cut back 10 national monuments, a couple of them by millions of acres. So, yes, I think it would be great for more authority and more consultation to incorporate tribal wisdom about that. I think it's a cooperative effort everywhere that needs to be in place to manage these public lands, again, with natural systems as the priority. It doesn't mean there's no place for any other activity on those lands, but we have to decide what's most important to us and what's most under threat. We don't need more coal mines.
Is it more from a political standpoint, though, is it advantageous to sell public lands because they don't produce any or as much revenue?
A lot of people think that that it is, who are paid to think that way by the oil and gas industry and the timber industry and the cattle industry. It depends what you mean by advantageous. If you want to advantage private industry in the short term for very short-term economic gain as a sort of a private piggy bank, yeah, that's advantageous. If you want to keep maintaining the kinds of natural systems that we see in national parks, then it is absolutely destructive, and that's what we're seeing now.
So it seems reasonable for public lands to be open to many different uses. How can we strike a happy medium between keeping public lands for conservation purposes but allowing some development at the same time? Where do you strike a balance?
Well, that's been the question for public lands outside national parks for about 100 years now, and it's the right question to ask. Sometimes we pretend we can do everything, but you can't have oil and gas drilling rigs and migrating antelope. You can't do intensive timber harvesting in your forests up there in Wisconsin and not have consequence for the wildlife. So, yes, there is a balance to be struck, but it can't be a political balance, and it can't be a balance that pretends that we can do everything simultaneously. It has to be a balance that acknowledges what's most important to us. Americans, this is not a partisan issue. Americans almost universally support the idea of maintaining in a sustainable way our natural systems and natural lands. And once we grasp the idea that national parks, those islands as you called them, can't be sustained by themselves, I think that priority will become clear. Everybody agrees.
Let's bring in Sophie to the conversation. Sophie in Madison, hi.
Hi. I just had a question because I know that you all were talking about kind of expediting trees or the movement of trees to kind of combat the impact that they might see from climate change. And I was wondering what kind of impact actually that might have on the environments that you introduce those trees into. I didn't know if sort of expediting that process and interfering more could potentially have a negative impact on the environments, the atmospheres that you would introduce those species to.
Yeah, so Sophie, wondering about ecosystems as they transform.
The idea of adaptive management in taking climate change into account by moving species into new ecosystems is still extremely controversial among conservation biologists, among people who are kind of wondering what can we do about climate change for the future. For now, in Wisconsin, for instance, there are just programs to help people keep the mix of species they've got, but it still acknowledges that some of those species are going to be disappearing, like balsam fir. You're right to suspect that you could create a lot of disruption by just saying, well, it's getting hotter, so we're going to move some of these species that we've got a couple of hundred miles north. It's going to take a lot of planning, a lot of research, really good research, and a lot of thinking that we're not currently doing to figure out whether that's a feasible idea or not. It's easy to say casually, but it may not work well.
Let's bring in Nate in Eau Claire now. Nate, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My experience is having some forest land here in Wisconsin that's under the Managed Forest Law, which is a state program run by state, you know, foresters. I initially was concerned because it requires cutting, but clear cutting in large areas has produced a huge boon in wildlife. More diversity of wildlife, more deer, more turkeys, more grouse, more of everything I can see. So initially I was reticent to have to cut down big chunks of my forest, but now that I've watched it over, you know, a decade or more, it's like the best thing for people who like the outdoors and people who like wildlife. So I think the knee-jerk reaction is people's, man, I can't stand to see those trees get cut down, and I couldn't, but I had to. Right? It was law. But once they did it, I was like, that's the best thing I ever did to see wildlife on my property. So
sometimes
people are concerned about losing the trees. Actually, it increases the biodiversity.
Nate bringing in biodiversity there, he sees the results of that logging. Stephen?
Yes. Sometimes when a storm comes through or a timber harvest comes through and releases new life in a forest, that's a wonderful thing, just so it's thoughtfully managed. You're absolutely right that some species do very, very well after a clear cut, and yet that is not a universal kind of principle at all. You can imagine what happens if we cut more forests than we should in just to increase the amount of wild turkeys. There has to be a kind of a mix that does not prioritize timber harvesting. Instead, it prioritizes the question, if we have a timber harvest, what's the likely result? So I'm glad that you're seeing those results on your land. That's not unusual, and you're right to think that it's a good thing. As long as the natural systems come first, there are things that we can do, like timber harvest on the land.
Stephen, in the last minute and a half or so, where do we go from here? What should we be thinking about, policies we should be forming, and how to protect public lands in the end?
So there are two opposing forces currently in the American conversation. One has to do with science and management and climate change and protecting those public lands, and the other one has to do with short-term profit. These are lands that have been protected to some degree. The national parks are the primary example because of fights that our great-grandparents had, fights that Teddy Roosevelt undertook. We're in the same kind of fight now, and the sooner we realize it, the better, that these public lands are our heritage, one that we want to protect and pass along. We don't want to bust it all up and sell it off. we want to connect those lands and protect them. That's the conversation that has to take place, and that's the fight we're going to have.
Would the public still have some regulatory authority over public lands if we do sell some off? Or what is, on the individual level, a person who lives near a forest, what can they do?
Breaking them up and selling them off is the final act. You'll never collect them back together. Yeah, you can have some regulation on the margins, but it's going to mean that gas and oil and coal and copper are the priorities. You can't put those natural systems back in any conceivable way. What to do? Yes, write your congressperson. Yes, pay attention politically. But yes, also go online, put in protecting public lands, just three words, and in something like a millionth of a minute, you'll have 50 ideas of groups around you in Wisconsin that are already fighting these battles, sometimes very successfully.
Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Stephen Nash is a visiting senior research scholar, adjunct faculty member in the Journalism Department and Environmental Studies at University of Richmond. Up next, it's news. Then we take a look at the most recent news from the state capitol, including tax cut plans and a lame duck litigation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.